This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum everyone. I am live again with Live Deen with another episode of Unveiling the Muslim Civilization. Brothers and sisters, I will begin in the name of Allah. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala khatamil anbiya wa sayyidil mursaleen wa ala alihi wa ashabihi al ghurril mayameen. وَمَنْ تَبِعَهُمْ بِإِحْسَانٍ إِلَىٰ يَوْمِ الدِّينِ أَمَّا بَعْدُ أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ السَّمِيعِ الْعَلِيمِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ بِسْمِ اللَّهِ الرَّحْمَنِ الرَّحِيمِ وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَاكَ إِلَّا رَحْمَةً لِلْعَالَمِينَ. Respected brothers and sisters in Islam, in Pakistan, in Britain, in the Middle East, in the Americas, wherever you may be, I welcome you all to another episode of Unveiling the Muslim Civilization. This particular series is absolutely crucial for people to learn about the Muslim civilization, more so for the Muslims than others, because the Muslims have been very, very ignorant in the past decades. I would say in the last century, Muslims have unfortunately ignored knowledge of their own civilization and the achievements in the past. Okay, and the reason why we have to revive the knowledge of the Muslim civilization and the achievements of the past is to highlight the fact that that Islam came as a force to reform humanity for the best. Islam was one of the best things that happened to humans. Okay. Contrary to what Islamophobes and haters and propagandists have been saying since 9/11. Okay, if you see our recent history, since the year 2001, after 9/11, a lot of Western media outlets and politicians and so-called intellectuals and academics have been tarnishing the name of Islam. They have been trying to link Islam with recent geopolitical, unfortunate, unpleasant events in the Middle East and beyond. Okay, so all of these geopolitical events that have been directly caused by the politics of the day are being linked to Islam. Okay, deliberately, it is quite deliberate. So, and this is happening for a reason. This is happening for a reason. The reason is to somehow put Muslims to shame, okay, or the Muslim youth to shame. If Muslim youth will have nothing positive, or they will know nothing positive about Islam and the Muslim civilization, they will start to drift away from Islam slowly. They will start to become apologetic about Islam and being Muslim, okay, and they will start to slowly abandon Islamic rights, Islamic principles, Islamic values, Islamic dress code, Islamic identity altogether. This is exactly what's happening today. Okay, the reason why Islam is being demonized and Muslims are being, tarnished and maligned around the world by the global media, the international media, which is, by the way, owned by few people, very few people in the Western world. The reason why this is happening is to do exactly what I described. okay, to put Islam on the back foot, to take away any sense of pride and any sense of celebration in the Muslim civilization or from the Muslim civilization, so that the Muslims start to feel ashamed about their faith and they start to drift away slowly. Okay, so it's not going to happen overnight, of course. The ones who are doing it, the Islamophobes or the Islamophobia industry, knows it well that it's not going to happen overnight. The process will have to continue possibly for a century, for 100 years. So slowly and steadily, what's happening right now is that Islam is being maligned. Islam and the Muslim civilization is being accused of spreading, how can I put it, maybe divisions in the world, right? While the reality is completely otherwise. It is to the contrary. Those Islamophobes are the ones who are dividing the world. Muslims are nearly 25% of the world. Okay, Muslims cherish a magnificent civilization behind them. So the purpose of these lectures is to educate the masses about the achievements of the great, the magnificent Islamic civilization. That's why we titled the series Unveiling the Muslim Civilization. And the purpose is to educate people. And through this education, people, Muslim youth in particular, and then masses in general will come to realize that what the Islamophobes or the Islamophobia industry is doing is all based upon lies, misinformation, misconceptions, and deliberately spread hate around the world. And this hate causes violence. What's happening in America? Rising Islamophobia in America, in Western Europe, okay? What have we learned from the Holocaust? What lessons were taken from the Holocaust? Why was Hitler evil? Why was he evil? Okay, he was evil because he killed, systematically wiped out an entire community from Germany. And how did Hitler get to that stage is the question. How did Hitler get to that stage? Hitler got to that stage by demonizing an entire community. It was a process of decades. Anti-Semitism was found in the foundations of the European society at the time. In the 19th century, it was on the rise. And then in the 20th century, it reached its peak, and the outcome, the ultimate outcome, the final solution, what the Nazis called it the final solution, was extermination. I ask this question: what are the European governments doing today in Europe? They are doing exactly that with the Muslims. They are doing this to the Muslim community. Okay? Today we got the news that Austrian Prime Minister, he has banned political Islam in Australia. Sorry, in Austria. In Austria. He has banned political Islam without explaining what that is. No explanation. Anything can be labeled as political Islam in Austria now. Hijab, your salah, your masajid, your institutions. If you get organized in any form, if you want to do a protest, for example, in favor of, let's say, some oppressed Muslims around the world, you will be seen as political Muslims and you will be doing something illegal in Austria. Okay, France, the French president who came out and who made ugly statements about Islam and Muslims. He said Islam is in crisis. Why is Islam in crisis? If Islam is in crisis, then what do we do with history of the Muslim civilization for 1,000 years when Europe was in crisis and Islam took it out of crisis? And this is exactly what I will be addressing in today's episode, inshallah, by the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we must not fall for propaganda. We must not fall for pressure and oppression from tyrannical fascist governments and politicians. The right wing, in other words, to put it in simple terms, racist Islamophobes and xenophobes have come to power in some countries in Europe, and they are being pushed by the media. Media is pushing politicians to go that way. Now we need to find out who owns the media. Who owns the media that is doing it to perfectly peaceful societies? European societies at large are perfectly peaceful. Who is causing these problems by spreading this hate in public and marginalizing a community that has been flourishing for the last 50 years, you know? And they put it down to these unfortunate events, these attacks done by some unfortunate, evil, uneducated, illiterate, drug-addicted individuals. A lot of these people who are doing these stupid attacks, okay, are possibly working for some unknown entities. They're not working for Muslims. They don't benefit the Muslims in any way. They do not benefit Islam and Muslim in any way, right? They are benefiting the Islamophobia industry, the international Islamophobia industry. This has to be remembered. They're not working for the Muslims. How are they benefiting the Muslims in the West? There are 10 million Muslims in Germany. There are 6 to 7 million Muslims in France. There are 3 to 4 million Muslims in Britain. And this is what's rocking the boat of xenophobes and Islamophobes and racist right-wing politicians, because the numbers of Muslims are growing. And in order to diminish these numbers, they want to call some sort of expulsion. They really want to ban Islam altogether eventually. And how they do that is slowly, gradually demonizing Islam and Muslims. And in 20 to 30 years, 50 years, we may be facing a completely different situation. That's why education is very important. Hence these lectures, Unveiling the Muslim Civilization. These lectures are absolutely crucial. They're very important for us to get to the bottom of all of this. So those of you who are watching it, brothers and sisters, please share this particular lecture online. Keep sharing it with your contacts on your Facebook pages, wherever you may be watching. Share this lecture so that other people can also watch this particular lecture. And if you have any comments and if you have any questions, please post them in the comment section, and I will try my best to read them and respond to them as I go along, inshallah ta'ala. So today's episode, we will be talking about the progress part. Remember, I gave you the golden chain of events. The golden chain of events was basically four elements that made the golden chain of events. The revelation of the Quran, justice that came from the Quran, and that justice gave peace, and peace facilitated progress, right? So progress cannot be achieved by peace. Peace in the Islamic civilization could not be achieved without the concept of justice that came from the Quran. The golden chain of events with four elements. Remember, to simplify things, how all the achievements of the Muslim civilization can be directly attributed to the root cause. What was the root cause? The Quran. The Quran gave rise to the Muslim civilization, the Islamic civilization. That's the point of it. Okay. The Quran, number one, is the root cause. Quran is at the root of it. Okay. All the great and positive and magnificent achievements of the Muslim civilization, from coexistence to consolidation of power and peace and harmony and justice and flourishing societies, and hustling and bustling markets, and book production and book markets, and observatories and scientists and intellectuals and poets and authors and generals and governments and monetary systems, okay, administrations from Spain to China. All of this was done by the revelation of the Quran. One root cause. Because how does it work? There is no Muslim civilization or the Islamic civilization without Islam. There is no Islam without the Quran. And the Quran is the root cause. The Quran is the root cause of all of it. The Book of Allah, it was revealed in the 7th century, and it taught a concept of justice. It taught a concept of justice. And this concept of justice was then practiced by the adherents of Islam. And then from this concept of justice was established peace throughout the Muslim civilization, from China to Spain. And why all this land was taken in the first place, I have discussed this topic in the first 3 to 4 episodes of Unveiling the Muslim Civilization. These episodes can be found on this very page where you're watching this live Deen page, and also these can be found on my YouTube channel, Adnan Rashid. If you type Adnan Rashid in YouTube, you will see my channel. Subscribe and watch this series there. We upload videos on a weekly basis. I will be answering some of your questions, inshallah, in due course. So keep posting them, inshallah. I will be answering them in due course. Okay, some people are posting some interesting questions there. So do not forget to share this video, this live feed, with your contacts, inshallah. Okay, sharing is caring, brothers and sisters. Okay, so I invite you to quickly go on to your Facebook pages and your social media pages and start sharing this live feed. So four chains, four elements in the chain, four elements, okay, the golden chain of events. We have covered the revelation of the Quran and justice that came from it and peace that was established through justice. The fourth element was progress. This is what I started in episode 7, which was the last episode. Today, episode 8 of the golden chain of events, we will be talking about, or episode 8 of Unveiling the Muslim Civilization, I will be continuing with the progress part. In the last episode, I talked about how the Muslim rulers and Muslim establishments from Spain to China, they established institutions, they established government centers, administrations, whereby people could live together. The law of Islam was applied. The law of Sharia was applied in these lands, okay? And this was not a utopia. I am not claiming a utopia. Utopia is a perfectly peaceful society where you see My Little Ponies flying around with rainbows. It wasn't like that. It has never been like that for humans, because humans are imperfect. A system can be perfect, but how it is applied is very important. But when we look at human history at large and we see the system of Islam, we see one of the best models in human history whereby people came together and lived in harmony, side by side in peace, without killing each other. Okay, the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims coexisted for over 1,000 years within the domain of Islam. Okay, the Muslims charged jizya from the Christians and the Jews, no doubt, and we discussed this topic in the previous episodes. If you want to know about jizya, go back to previous episodes, inshallah, and you will find out what jizya is and how it was applied. Okay, after applying jizya, the Muslims were asked to pay zakat, okay? So the government was charging taxes, respectively, from different communities. These communities came together and they flourished and they produced a flourishing civilization, okay? And I was talking about what happened in Spain. Spain stood out as an example of advancement, of coexistence, of convivencia, okay? Where people live together and they produced amazing results. So today I will be focusing on book production throughout the Muslim civilization. So we are still going through the progress part, which is the fourth element of the golden chain of events. I want everyone to remember the golden chain of events. Okay, this chain, the golden chain of events, will really enable you to do justice with I will be sharing this very quickly, this live feed, so that other people can join us, inshallah. Okay. Okay, so today, inshallah, in this episode, we will be talking about book production, the progress part, the fourth element within the golden chain of events, okay? So Quran gave justice, justice gave peace, peace gave progress. So we are dealing with progress. After establishing power in this large chunk of land throughout the Muslim civilization, Muslims started to make progress, which was a natural outcome of peace they had established. It wasn't perfect. Again, I want to emphasize the point. It was not a utopia. We're not claiming paradise on earth. We're not claiming some sort of some sort of a perfect situation between communities. No, because disturbances were happening. There were rebellions. There were wars. There were battles. There were even massacres at some time. Okay, at some points. throughout the Muslim civilization, the history. I am talking about the history of 1,000 years, the general pattern of the history. I'm not talking about specifics. I'm not talking about exceptions. I'm talking about the norm throughout the Muslim civilization. How did people live? What did they do from Spain to China? Muslims governed parts of Spain for over 700 years. Muslims governed land from China. When I say China, I mean northern China, right? What we call Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, all these lands, Central Asia, what we call Central Asia, right? Muslims governed all this land for close to 1,000 years. And a lot of these lands are still governed by Muslims, okay? Albeit nominal Muslims, these lands are not being governed by the laws of Islam because of colonialism and occupations, okay? Russia occupied all of that Central Asian region, and a lot of these nations, unfortunately, or a lot of these people, they became communist because of that influence. And then after colonialism, colonization of the Muslim lands in the Middle East and in India and beyond, colonial influences are still found there. So the law of Islam is not fully applied in these lands, but the culture has survived. Islam is still very much alive from Morocco to Bangladesh. It is still very much alive. It still lives as a civilization, albeit in a partial form, but it is there, right? So what I want you to understand is, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, those of you who are watching, progress came directly from that peace which the Muslims established from China to Spain, okay? This peace was generally established for everyone. Christians, Jews, and Muslims lived side by side under the domain of Islam, under the law of Islam. The law of Islam was applied by different dynasties at different times in different places, right? Okay, if you're talking about the Umayyads, the Abbasids, the Ottomans, the Ayyubids, the Mughals were not very, they couldn't apply the law of Islam in India because they were a minority. The majority was Hindu, so they did what they could. They did introduce the civilization of Islam in its own specific form, but Mughal India was never fully governed by the laws of Islam because it was practically impossible. The majority were Hindu, so it is not possible, and it is not even Islamic to apply the law of Islam on non-Muslims. By the way, this is something very important I want to mention passingly. The law of Islam is not applied on non-Muslims. Non-Muslims are perfectly free. They are allowed to live by their own laws and their own regulations, what we call judicial autonomies. Non-Muslims from Spain to China, again, they were allowed their judicial autonomies. And this was the consistent pattern of the Muslim civilization. Whether it were Umayyads or Abbasids or the Ottomans, wherever the Muslims governed with the law of Islam, in whatever form, non-Muslims were allowed to live by their own rules and their laws. Okay, the Christians were governed by their bishops. The Jews were governed by their Beth Dins, their own rabbinic courts. There were rabbinic courts in Ottoman Salonika. There were rabbinic courts in Baghdad. There were rabbinic courts in Spain. So the pattern is consistent. Okay, it was not an accident to have rabbinic courts in Spain, for example, and in other lands they didn't exist. No, the law of Islam allowed the Jews and the Christians to live by their own rules and regulations. The Christians could farm pigs, they could drink wine, so long as they did not sell it to Muslims. That would be a crime. But they could produce wine, they could farm pigs within the lands of Islam, by the way, under the law of Sharia, the Sharia law. Okay, they could do all these things, and they lived side by side with other communities, living within their own rules. No secular country in the world today, brothers and sisters, no secular nation allows judicial autonomies to other communities today in this world. Even the most liberal of nations, okay? Austria banned political Islam today as we speak. They are banning, they're going towards it. They're going to ban it in December. They are already proposing it. Banning political Islam. In other words, you cannot have your own rules as Muslims. Muslims might not even be allowed to slaughter halal, have halal meat. Muslims might not be able to have their, imams sitting over the matters to do with divorce and marriage and things like that. All of that might come under political Islam. But Muslims, Islamic civilization allowed judicial autonomies to all other communities to live by their own laws. And they did. They worshipped in the temples and in the synagogues and the churches. They lived, they flourished for over 1,000 years. All of this was disturbed by the wars and the disturbances of the 20th century. This was all disturbed. What was happening in the Muslim civilization, the achievements of the civilization of Islam were dismantled and disturbed and demolished by what European powers or Western powers did in the 20th century. And it still continues to happen, unfortunately, throughout the Muslim lands. Okay, so brothers and sisters, it is very, very sad for us to talk about it, but it is true. Okay, so progress that was achieved in the Muslim civilization was coexistence, and from this coexistence came a lot of literature, a lot of knowledge. People, scholars from different parts of the world, they started to travel to the Muslim lands. They started to live there. They started to produce works. Greek works were translated, as I explained in the previous episode. A lot of Greek works were translated into the Arabic language in Baghdad. Okay, from the time of Abu Ja'far al-Mansur, the Abbasid Caliph onwards, al-Ma'mun took it to a different level altogether. You know, where this institution called Bayt al-Hikmah was established, and many Greek works were translated into the Arabic language. With that translation movement came beneficial and non-beneficial knowledge. So a lot of this knowledge was to do with medicine, possibly architecture. A lot of this knowledge had to do with mathematics. Okay, so practical knowledge which was used for the benefit of humanity. With this knowledge came Aristotelian skepticism and Greek philosophy. That kind of, disturbed the balance throughout the Muslim civilization for some time, until the traditionists or the ulama or the muhaddithin throughout the Muslim civilization were able to take back control from the Mu'tazila, from the rationalists, who were directly inspired by Greek philosophy. They started to use the Greek philosophical lens to study Islam. So the Quran would only make sense if it fits into Greek philosophy. To them, to the rationalists, who were also called the Mu'tazila, the Quran would only make sense, or the Quran can only be interpreted by using ideas of Aristotle and Plato, for example. Okay, Hadith would only be accepted, the tradition of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam would only be accepted if it makes rational sense according to the Greek philosophy. Okay, according to the Greek philosophy. This is why many Muslim thinkers later on criticized Greek philosophy, having studied it. Al-Ghazali was one of them, Imam Ghazali. He wrote Tahafat al-Falasifa, Incoherence of the Philosophers, for that particular purpose. Ibn Taymiyyah, rahmatullahi alayhi, Shaykh al-Islam, later on also wrote a book, Ar-Rad al-Mantaqiyin, a refutation of rationalists, basically. He wrote this particular book, and this book, you can find it translated by Wael B. Hallaq. Wael B. Hallaq has made a translation of Ibn Taymiyyah's book, Ar-Rad al-Mantaqiyin. So, putting that aside, what happened after the translation movement? A lot of this knowledge of Islam and knowledge of Greek sciences was translated into Arabic. Okay, and a lot of this knowledge didn't contradict Islam. It was highly beneficial, the knowledge of Greek medicine, for example. Many Muslim scholars were theologians, as well as medical practitioners. They took this knowledge, they experimented on a lot of this knowledge, and they corrected the Greeks where they were wrong. So a lot of people who claim that, oh, Muslims didn't do nothing special, Muslims are just simply copiers, they were copiers, they simply copied, plagiarized from the Greeks, and they moved this knowledge forward to the Europeans. And the Europeans are the ones who actually really benefited from this knowledge. This is all a lie. In fact, you can find a lot of this stuff refuted in this book. Okay, a lot of these ideas you can see dealt with in this particular book, titled The Hidden Debt to Islamic Civilization. The Hidden Debt to Islamic Civilization will take you through that particular refutation, whereby this scholar, he actually explains how this idea that Muslims are simply plagiarizers and did not make any changes to the Greek knowledge is refuted, is thoroughly refuted in this particular book. Okay, that idea. So Muslims, they took knowledge from the Greeks, they experimented, they conducted their own experiments, they found many errors with the Greeks, and they corrected the Greeks, and then they started to teach this corrected, researched, revisited knowledge throughout the Muslim civilization. So books were produced on a massive scale, on an industrial scale. Okay, books were produced in Arabic on these sciences. For example, alchemy, which is called chemistry today. Okay, and from alchemy came a lot of other knowledge that helped people produce medicines, okay, make other things for daily use. And Muslim civilization took production, manufacture to a completely different level because of this new knowledge they found with other civilizations. So the Quran drove Muslims to seek knowledge. The Quran took Muslims to a level of understanding of the universe whereby they started to study it. It was the Quran that encouraged the Muslims to study. The first commandment in the Quran was to read. Okay, اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق خلق الإنسان من علق اقرأ وربك الأكرم الذي علم بالقلم علم الإنسان ما لم يعلم. Okay, the first five verses of the Quran, which can be found in chapter 96 today, the first five verses were revealed about knowledge, about reading and writing and studying and learning. Okay, for that reason the Muslims started to learn, they started to study. And they studied everything. They studied the Quran, they studied the Hadith, they studied fiqh, they studied the Arabic language, they mastered Arabic poetry. After doing all that, mastering the Islamic tradition, and the Islamic tradition opened their minds to the natural phenomena, they started to study sciences, Greek science, Greek mathematics, Greek alchemy, Greek medicine, for example, okay, Greek geometry, okay. All these fields were studied by the Muslims, okay, and happily adopted from other civilizations. The Byzantine Empire had a lot of these works locked up in the libraries, in the book collections, and the Muslims acquired them. And after this acquisition, these books were translated. So, all of these works were studied by Muslim theologians, Muslim scholars. Some of the people got heavily influenced by Greek philosophy, and they became rationalists. Now, you may think, what's wrong with becoming rationalists? Those rationalists were quite different. They were rationalists in the Greek sense. They would take Greek philosophy as be all and you know, basically everything. Okay, it is the end. Greek philosophy is the best human achievement to them, right? Those rationalists, they started to use the Greek philosophy to study Islam, and that caused problems. But other people who were studying other practical, okay, sciences like mathematics, chemistry, books on medicine and other fields, they started to translate these works into the Arabic language. And then these works were disseminated from China to Spain. As I talked about it last week, that there were Umayyad kings, caliphs, who were taking this knowledge through books. They were book collectors. Hakam II, the Umayyad caliph in Spain, he had accumulated a library of 400,000 volumes. He was such an avid book collector that he had 500,000 books in his library. This was possibly the largest library in the world at the time. Okay, this was probably, unless we find another collection like that at that time in the 10th century, okay, this was probably the largest collection of books in the world at that time. Okay, Hakam the Second's library in Spain, in Cordoba, in Córdoba. Okay, 400,000 volumes in one place, gathered for the Caliph. And of course, these volumes consisted of commentaries on the Quran, Hadith, poetry, literature, mathematics, alchemy, medicine, okay, astronomy, study of the heavens, heavenly bodies, stars, okay, planets, okay, and fields such as, optics, right? All the scientific fields you can think about. All the fields available at that time where the scholars were studying these fields were found in this particular library. You name it. It was all there, okay? And Muslim civilization pioneered book production. It took book production to a completely different level. At that time, this was the largest enterprise when it comes to book manufacturing, okay? Of course, how were they producing books? Books were entirely handwritten, okay? There were no printing presses at that time. Of course, the Chinese had started printing on paper, whatever paper they were using at that time, whatever the form of the paper was at that time. But that technology was not generally known to humanity. So humans, generally speaking, were writing books on very expensive materials at that time. When the Muslims came to power, when the Islamic civilization took hold of global politics from China to Spain, at that time, the substance that was used to copy books was vellum, skin, leather. It was very expensive. This is why books were hardly available. So how did this knowledge become widely available? Because the Muslims made paper available. Paper mills were produced. Paper was produced on massive scale, on an industrial scale. You may be thinking, what did the paper of that time look like? I don't have paper from that time, but I have paper from much later on. This is what it might have looked like. Okay, this is a Quran from possibly the 15th century. Okay, this is a 15th century Quran in my hand, and it is very, very old. Subhanallah. Okay, this is what paper looked like at that time. Okay, so the Muslims started to establish paper mills. They started to, among other things Muslims are doing, they were conducting experiments, astronomical experiments. They were creating observatories. They had taken, of course, this knowledge from other civilizations. A lot of this impetus, this inspiration came from the Greeks and the Persians and the Indians and other civilizations. Muslims took this knowledge and they started to experiment on it. Having studied the theology in depth, a lot of these people who were doing this work were ulama. They were scholars. They were muhaddithin, they were fuqaha, okay? They were poets, they were intellectuals. At the same time, they took up science, they took up experiments. And the reason why I'm talking about science and book production is not to show that this was the only achievement of Islam and Muslims, or this was the greatest achievement of Islam and Muslims. No, far from it. The greatest achievement of Islam and Muslims in the Muslim civilization was peaceful coexistence. They brought humanity together to do all of this. That was the greatest achievement. Peace and harmony established in societies. No hate against Jews. No hate against Christians. And whenever it was, it managed to, make its way through society, it caused destruction. There were pogroms. There were massacres of the Jewish people twice that happened in the Muslim history in Spain. Only twice, right? And that happened because this idea of hate was taken lightly, okay? And that caused massacres, okay? But in the Christian world, it was taken very lightly all the way. That's why the Jewish people could not easily live in Christendom. They had to move to the Muslim lands to live in freedom and live in peace, okay? This is a completely different topic, Jews and Islam and how the Muslims treated the Jewish people. That's a completely different topic. In fact, some scholars believe the Jewish people survived expulsion and extermination throughout the Middle Ages in Europe because the Muslims gave them refuge. Muslims gave the Jewish people refuge. So all of this was the greatest achievement of Islam and Muslims, right? So book production is a side thing. It is important, but it is a side thing. So you must understand, brothers and sisters, that please do share this live feed with others, those who may be interested in watching, so that you can, inshallah, share this message and this this content with other people online, inshallah ta'ala. So if you're watching, share it, inshallah, with others. So brothers and sisters, book production, coming back to it, paper was produced on an industrial scale. There were paper mills all over the Muslim world, okay? So when paper was made available in the book markets, that resulted in massive, massive, massive book production. Volumes upon volumes were put together, okay? Like, this is another copy of the Quran. You can see it is entirely handwritten, tiny script, okay? You can see it here. This paper, again, is old, right? Paper like this was produced in tons, right? And book copiers, authors, writers, scribes started to use paper to copy important books, right? So previously, when books were written on vellum, on parchment, when those books were being written on parchment, because of the cost and because of the labor that was required to produce a parchment or even a volume this thick, okay, so that it can be transcribed or so that it can be used for writing, they could only use one volume, okay? They could only choose, basically. Their options are very limited. So they had to write the most important works, okay, in these volumes that costed a lot of money. But when they were produced in paper, now you had options. You had so many books that needed to be written, and this is why the Muslim civilization, by making paper easily available to throughout the world, from Spain to China, Muslim civilization, it produced a revolution of education. Okay, this was a revolution of education whereby throughout the Muslim civilization, whoever governed, wherever people were governed, right, they started to produce books on a massive scale. All of these books were distributed, okay, in libraries throughout the Muslim world, from, again, Central Asia to Spain, okay, Baghdad, Damascus, Samarkand, Bukhara, okay, Nishapur, for example, in Persia, okay, Marv, for example, okay, cities like Baghdad, okay, in Iraq, okay, in Mecca, in Medina, okay, Kairouan, Cairo, for example, in North Africa. And if you move on to Spain, Cordoba, okay, Toledo, right, Valencia, Seville, all of these cities, they became hubs of book markets. Book markets were established, and book markets were the busiest places in the Muslim world, throughout the Muslim civilization. Okay, you may have vegetable market, you may have meat market, you may have market like a supermarket. If you walk into a Walmart, if you walk into Asda or Tesco, if you live in Britain, okay, you can see everything there. Okay, I'm pretty sure there were markets in the Muslim world that had things for daily use, right? But book markets appeared to be the busiest places throughout the Muslim world. Okay. And people were buying books from these markets, and these books are being copied again and again and again because paper was cheap. It was easily available. There were mills making paper in tons. So now book production was not an elite enterprise. Rather, the society took full advantage of it. Jewish children, Christian children, and Muslim children, they started to learn. They started to learn the sciences of Islam. They started to learn. They started to read Muslim literature. Okay. They started to indulge in Muslim theology, Muslim poetry, then Greek works translated into Arabic, written and corrected by Muslim scholars and non-Muslim scholars for that matter. The Jewish scholars and the Christian scholars were all working together in this, right? So one of the interesting quotes which I want to read in front of you, with you, to highlight how this book production had affected societies at that time is fascinating, because some Christian students, they started to read Muslim works. They started to go into Muslim literature, and there was a Christian author called Paul Alvarez in the 9th century writing in Cordoba in 850s in Cordoba. He saw what was happening and he wanted to pick on it. He wanted to talk about it. So I am looking for the quote. It is here with me right now and I will be reading it. Okay, so the quote basically is, Paul Alvarez, here it is. Paul Alvarez was an author writing in Cordoba in 850s. Okay, the Umayyad Caliphate has been established for nearly a century. Okay, 850s is a very flourishing time in Spain, okay, where Christians, Muslims and Jews are living together and they're flourishing, and the Islamic society is governed by the Muslim law, the Sharia law, and a lot of good stuff is happening. There are academies, there are libraries, there are schools, there are madaris, okay, there are markets, there are homes, there are palaces. This is a flourishing city. In fact, Cordoba was one of the largest cities in the world in the 10th century, in particular at the time of Abdurrahman III, the most powerful Umayyad caliph to have governed the land of Spain. At that time, Cordoba was the largest city in the world. Paul Alvarez was a Catholic monk writing in Cordoba at that time. So what did this book production do? What did this achievement of book writing and book distribution do? Okay, for Christians and Jews in particular. So he writes, and this is again in the 850s, in the 9th century, and I quote, "The Christians love to read the poems and romances of the Arabs. They study the Arab theologians and philosophers not to refute them, but to form a correct and elegant Arabic. Where is the layman who now reads the Latin commentaries on the Holy Scriptures, or who studies the Gospels, prophets or apostles? Alas, all talented young Christians read and study with enthusiasm the Arab books. They gather immense libraries at great expense. They despise the Christian literature as unworthy of attention. They have forgotten their own language. For every one who can write a letter in Latin to a friend, there are 1,000 who can express themselves in Arabic with elegance and write better poems in his language than the Arabs themselves." Wow. Okay. Paul Alvarez was a clergy himself, and his purpose in the above passage was to praise Islam and its effects. Rather, he was bemoaning was not to praise Islam, by the way. He was not trying to praise Islam here. He's basically bemoaning the Christian inclinations towards the culture of Islam. So he was basically crying about it, that why are the Christian youngsters reading Muslim books? And what he calls Muslim books were Arabic translations of Greeks, of Persians, and for example, Arabic poetry of Muslim poets and non-Muslim pre-Islamic poets, and Arabic poetries of the Jewish poets, Arabic poetry of the Christian poets. So Arabic language had become the lingua franca, and all important literature was found in the Arabic language. So Paul Alvarez in the 9th century in Cordoba, in the city of Cordoba, he's crying about this situation where the Christians are becoming heavily influenced by the civilization of Islam. Okay, Jessica A. Koop is an author. She's a scholar who has written a book titled The Martyrs of Cordoba. Okay, in this book, she talks about a movement that came as a result. Because Christian youngsters were reading Muslim books that were easily available in the libraries of Cordoba, okay, and the rest of the Muslim world, okay, in Cordoba, particularly, there was this situation where a lot of these young Christians were getting influenced by Islam and its literature. Okay, they were becoming inspired by the Muslim civilization. Okay, they were basically falling in love with the Muslim civilization, if you like. Okay, and the result was many of them were coming to Islam. Many of them were becoming Muslims. Okay, there were mass conversions in the 9th and the 10th century to Islam. Christians, and in some cases Jewish authors, writers, intellectuals, okay, researchers were becoming Muslims. And those who were not authors and scholars, they were simply looking at the peace and justice of the Muslims and Islam, and they were coming to Islam. So they were inspired by the Muslim civilization. And the fear, Jessica A. Koop, in her book, The Martyrs of Cordoba, she states, the worst fear of the radicals, and I'm quoting, was that Christians would not only work for Muslims and read Arabic literature, but would eventually convert to Islam. They would eventually convert to Islam. A man who associated too long with Muslims was liable to turn into one himself. Jessica A. Koop, in her book, The Martyrs of Cordoba, an excellent book, a must read. You must get a copy of this book. It's very difficult to find. I hope you can find a PDF somewhere. The Martyrs of Cordoba, published in 2003 by Jessica A. Koop. In this book, Jessica talks about how the Christian mission, you know, not missionaries, sorry, Christian clergy and radical Christians, these extremist Christians, a lot of them who had a problem with this phenomenon of many young Christians reading Arabic literature and as a consequence possibly becoming Muslims, they started to now come up with an idea. And the idea was to basically insult the Prophet in front of the Muslims and Muslim judges and get executed as a result, basically. This is the game they started to play, because at that time the law of Islam stipulated that no one can insult God and his prophets. Okay, so the law of Islam stipulated in Spain and elsewhere throughout the Muslim civilization that you cannot insult God within the Muslim domain. Okay, you may live in peace, you may worship as you like in your synagogues and churches, but you cannot insult God, Allah, and any of his prophets to protect the honor and the sanctity. So they found, the Christians found this loophole, and they started to curse the Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and criticize him and say very bad things about him in markets. Okay, and they would go to the court, the Islamic court, and they would shout this insult. So obviously the law would be applied, they would be arrested, and they would be punished for that reason. So for this reason, they were called the Martyrs of Cordoba. Okay, and Jessica A. Koop in this book writes this fascinating history of this movement and how it failed eventually to convince the majority of the Muslims who enjoyed the peace and harmony in Al-Andalus in Spain at that time. They, the majority of the Christians, they started to speak up against this group of extremists who were doing this to turn the Christians away from Islam. So why they were doing it? Because they will be punished and there will be sympathy for them, and that sympathy will cause the Christians to become angry with the Muslims. It will cause them to become angry with the Muslims, and as a result, they will start to go away from Islam and Muslim, and they will stop reading Islamic literature and Islamic philosophy and Islamic poetry and all of that. Okay, so to do this movement, the Martyrs of Cordoba, was initiated, but it failed miserably within 10 years. It was basically rejected by the majority of the Christians who were living in Cordoba and wider land of Spain. They rejected this movement and these bigots and these extremists, and they said, we are perfectly fine. They have nothing to do with us. We have nothing to do with them. Okay. So this was one of the aspects of the book production Muslims had achieved throughout the Muslim civilization. Okay. Books were produced on a massive scale from China to Spain. Mills upon mills were created, and these mills were producing paper. This paper was put into volumes like this, into empty volumes, and then these volumes were filled with writing. Okay, so printing was to come later, of course, in Europe in the 15th century, during the Renaissance period, right? But the Muslims had produced hundreds of thousands of volumes, millions of volumes, whereby scholars could easily access libraries and they could study all these books available in these libraries from northern China to Spain. Okay, these are public libraries. In Cordoba alone, there were 70 public libraries. This was the first time in history of humanity when so many public libraries were available. Okay, people talk about the Library of Alexandria in antiquity, of course, but there was only one library, and even that library was only open to the elite, to the philosophers, or to the rulers. It was not open for the masses, for the public, whereby they could walk in and start reading books. But in Cordoba, there were 70 public libraries where people could walk in, pick up a volume, and start reading from it and learning from it. And there were classes taking place in Cordoba Mosque, where scholars were teaching to Jewish, Christian, and Muslim students. So Cordoba produced a flourishing civilization whereby works of immense importance were produced, researches were conducted, institutions were established, scholars were produced. These scholars studied all these works produced throughout the Muslim civilization, and they started to write commentaries, they started to conduct experiments, they started to write their original works in the Arabic language. And then these works were disseminated throughout the Muslim world. So the Muslim world became a hub of learning. When I say the Muslim world, I mean the world from northern China to Spain. This large stretch of land. If you were to take a flight today from China for Spain, it would take you possibly 10 hours to get there. I don't know what the flying time would be, okay? At that time, if you were to travel from Central Asia, let's say, one of the countries next to China, Turkmenistan or Kyrgyzstan, if you were to take that journey for Spain, you would probably get to Spain in 2 years. This is how large this stretch of land was. And Muslims had taken all of it in the 7th century. And after that, this happened, institutionalization of knowledge and learning, and libraries were produced, institutions were produced throughout the Muslim civilization. Okay, so brothers and sisters, what do we learn today? We learn today that this progress, we are talking about book production and book distribution and production of scholars and knowledge and institutionalization of knowledge and education, all of this was achieved by the Muslim civilization. Okay, inspiration for seeking knowledge came from the Quran directly. Quran was directly responsible for producing all of this. Okay, Quran instigated this. And these works were mostly original works produced by Muslim scholars. Okay, so works like works of Jabir ibn Hayyan, for example. Okay, works of Ibn Nafis, works of Ibn al-Haytham, works of Abul Qasim al-Zahrawi, for example, or works of Ibn Rushd, for example, or works of al-Ghazali. All of these works, okay, or Al-Khawarizmi, for example, okay, all of these works were distributed throughout the Muslim lands and they were placed in Muslim libraries. That's why later on, European scholars appeared to be so deeply inspired by this knowledge. To an extent, they were using Muslim scholars and their names as references in their books. Later on, these names were Latinized. They were Latinized, and they can still be found in medieval Latin manuscripts that were translated from Arabic works. These Latin translations were made from Arabic in northern Spain for the wider use of the Europeans later on. And this is the aspect of progress I will be talking about next week, inshallah ta'ala. I will be talking in episode 9 of Unveiling the Muslim Civilization, how this knowledge, this paper production, this book production throughout the Muslim civilization changed the history and the destiny of Western Europe in particular forever. Okay, how Europe is today, generally speaking, and I am not saying all Europeans, the governments in particular, how they are promoting Islamophobia, how they are funding Islamophobia, how they are themselves victims of Islamophobia, is very, very sad. If they knew what Islam and Muslims have done for Western Europe in particular, how Islam civilized the Western Europe, lands like Germany, France, and Britain, and Spain, if they were to know this, they would reconsider their positions. And this is the point we will address, inshallah, in next episode, episode 8 of Unveiling the Muslim Civilization, as to how this book production, these original works produced by Muslim scholars, these original researches, these original institutionalized academic works, how they were brought to Europe and how the Europeans took benefit from these works will be addressed, inshallah, in the next episode. Until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. If you have any questions, please post them here so that I can respond to your questions, inshallah. Okay? Please post your questions in the comment section so that I can respond to them, inshallah. Okay, it seems there are 4 questions there. Although it's not directly related to this topic, the question is, was Tipu Sultan Shia? The answer is no. Okay, and if you want to see a detailed response to this, please go to my YouTube channel. There is a lecture on Tipu Sultan. Watch that lecture and you will get the answer there as well. Okay, if there are any questions, please post them in the comment section on Live Deen page and I will answer your questions, inshallah. If there are no questions, then the time is up and I will end the talk for now. And inshallah, we will meet with you next week again to discuss another aspect of the Muslim civilization under the title Unveiling the Muslim Civilization, inshallah. Okay, I want to quickly check if there are any more questions on a different page. Someone asked, sir, how can I understand the whole of Islamic history? You cannot possibly understand the whole of Islamic history or all of Islamic history. You will have to focus. You can read general books, general introductions to the history of Islam, but you cannot possibly study all the history of Islam, because it's so vast, it's so much. So you will have to read general introductions and then choose anything that interests you and master that. I recommend that some people master certain aspects of Islamic history so that we can start teaching them in universities around the world, inshallah. Anyone else, any more questions, please put them forward and I will try my best to respond to those questions, okay? I will see if there are any more questions on another page. Right. Are there any questions on this page? It seems no. So thank you very much, brothers and sisters, for watching. May Allah bless you. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accept from you. And I will see you for the 9th episode of Unveiling the Muslim Civilization next Saturday. Until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa akhiru da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.